here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Today is Friday, September 28th. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Phil Chang. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to UBC campus and to the residents of Vancouver and all listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:10 p.m. and time for close to another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Today we have an interview with Mike Scott, CEO of NextEra Systems, based in Vancouver. He talks to us about NextEra NGE's clean energy facility that recently opened at UBC, which provides clean heat and electricity from renewable bioenergy. We also have an interview with Bill Hopwood from Raise the Rates, as well as our science segment, Simply Science, with Sarah Chow, and our health segment, Dietetic Intuition.
All that, plus your weekend weather forecast, here brought to you by the UBC Storm Club, all on here, News 101, your source for independent news. Now, for our campus and local headlines.
The University of British Columbia's Board of Governors has approved a comprehensive housing program designed to help more UBC faculty, staff, and students live on its Vancouver campus. As a result, UBC will expand housing for its academic community and workforce on campus, becoming the only Lower Mainland employer to offer sufficient levels of restricted housing to employees, and one of the world's first universities to offer non-profit housing to low-income staff. Up to 30% of UBC's future housing will be made available only to faculty and staff under restricted housing programs. Up to 20% of future units will be available to staff or faculty as restricted rentals. And up to 10% of future units will be restricted home ownership for faculty. UBC will also introduce a pilot nonprofit housing program intended for full-time staff with household incomes of less than $64,000 a year. UBC is currently developing a plan to implement the new program soon because the Vancouver campus has stated that it is committed to keeping its student housing, currently the largest in Canada at 9,000 beds, at below market rates.
On Wednesday, Coast Capital Savings announced that it contributed $1 million to the Sauder School of Business at UBC. This funding is aimed at establishing the Coastal Capital Savings Innovations Hub, a program supporting early-stage ventures dedicated to solving social and environmental problems using for-profit business models. Led by Sauder's ISIS Research Center, the initiative will provide working space, mentoring from faculty, alumni, and industry experts, as well as support from Sauder students paired with ventures as interned. Ventures will be selected through a competitive process, assessing their financial sustainability as well as their potential to have a positive social impact. Program participants will attend boot camps on topics from marketing to branding to legal and tax implications. So here is some data to get some sense of the success of these ventures. In 2009, the BC Alberta Social Economic Research Alliance reported that social ventures provided paid employment to 4,500 workers. The sector generated annual revenues of $46 million, provided training to 10,450 services, as well as 678,000 British Columbians.
The University of British Columbia and Langara College have partnered to create a transfer program to support First Nations, Métis, and Inuit students working toward a university degree. The UBC Langara Aboriginal Transfer Program, the first of its kind in BC, will offer up to $8,500 in scholarships to Aboriginal students, plus guaranteed admission to UBC's Faculty of Arts and personalized support from Aboriginal advisors at both institutions. Program students will complete 1 or 2 years of courses at Langara, including a newly created Aboriginal Plus program, which aims to prepare students for academic success through workshops, extracurricular activities, and support from Aboriginal staff and faculty at both institutions. Langara students who meet program requirements will receive guaranteed admission to the Faculty of Arts here at UBC, and by maintaining high academic standards, program students will be eligible for scholarships.
In local news, on Wednesday, the Chilliwack RCMP announced that one woman, 40-year-old Dawn Robinstad, is now facing charges after RCMP shut down an alleged fraud ring. On September 19th, the RCMP seized approximately 1,000 stolen or fraudulent credit cards, driver license, rare cards, SIM cards, as well as firearm licenses, after they obtained a search warrant for a house in the 46,000 block of Yale Road in Chilliwack. Investigator Corporal Kurt Bosniel said the bust was bigger than anticipated, with police tracing the stolen cards back to thefts between 2009 and 2012. Many of these cards were stolen in dozens of breaks and enter thefts for vehicles in Chilliwack in the Fraser Valley. Bosniel also said, what was the most disturbing was that a lot of the personal information was taken from hard drives stolen from retail stores. Bosniel said that the suspect pulled credit card numbers and personal information off of these hard drives, then researched the names online on sites such as Facebook to create full fraudulent profiles and IDs of the theftees. Not only did the criminals have access to people's valid credit cards, they also manufactured fake IDs replacing the victim's photo with the suspect so that the user could use the credit cards and apply for new ones under the victim's name.
Delegates at the Union of British Columbia Municipalities voted in favor of a motion supporting the decriminalization of marijuana. The motion, put forward by the Victoria suburb of Metchosin, argued that marijuana prohibition is, quote, a failed policy which has cost millions of dollars in police, court, jail, and social costs, end quote. A note from the resolution committee said BC is responsible for 40% of the marijuana produced in Canada, and as much as 95% of it is illegally exported to the United States, and that much of the production is done by criminal gangs. Other representatives argued that keeping marijuana illegal is a missed opportunity to raise tax revenue and that too much is spent on policing related to it. Earlier in the week, a well-attended panel discussion debated the pros and cons of decriminalizing marijuana. Speakers included former Attorney General Jeff Plant, Victoria officer, Police Officer David Bratzer, and University of the Fraser Valley criminologist Daryl Plikas.
So those are your UBC campus and local headlines here on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for our interview with Bill Hopwood from Raise the Rates, as well as your local weather forecast.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We now go to our interview with Bill Hopwood from Raise the Rates. Hi, Bill.
Hello there.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. So, Bill, could you introduce ourselves to our listeners?
Who I am? I'm Bill Hopwood. I am an organizer with Raise the Rates, which is a coalition in British Columbia that works to get rid of poverty in the province. And the terrible poverty we have in this province, and in particular for those people who are unable to work for whatever reasons, who are living on welfare.
Right. And so Raise the Rates recently initiated a challenge that will start on October 16th, which is World Food Day.
Yes.
So tell us a bit more about who will be a part of this challenge and what the challenge's goals are.
Okay. I'll go back a little bit, just explain to the listeners what we're challenging people to do, if that's okay.
Of course, yes.
Basically, if you are on the single-person welfare rate, by the time you've paid for your rent, you're having a wash once in a while, having a cell phone so you can look for work and things, you start off with $610 for everything, but by the time you paid for housing and things, you're left with around $26 a week for food. And basically what we are challenging people to do is for 1 week to live as if they were on welfare. So to spend for the total food money they spend for 1 week is $26. Now, it's just for 1 week. It's not like if you're on disability and you're there for life or for a long time. So at the moment, we've already got... I'm losing track because I keep getting emails. But let's say we've got 10, 15 people already doing it from various walks of life, from a dietitian to a public health officer, community activist. There's at least a couple of teachers who have already volunteered. So they're going to spend 1 week, as you said, from October 16th, so we start with World Food Day, and the next day is World Poverty Day. So they'll spend that 1 week and only be able to spend $26 for the week on food, and they're going to tell people in their blogs, email, newspapers, radio programs what it's like to be hungry for a week.
So this number, $26 a week, is that on a national level, or is it...
That's provincial.
Provincial, right.
The welfare rates in Canada are under the control of the provinces.
Right.
So each province has slightly different rates, and it varies depending on where you are in Canada. But one of the things we can say is that British Columbia has the worst adult poverty and joint worst child poverty of any province in Canada. And what's particularly concerning is that there are now only two provinces in Canada that don't have an anti-poverty strategy, and those are British Columbia, which is the worst for poverty, and Saskatchewan. So, you can see from that we need to do something to tackle the poverty in this province.
Absolutely.
So, Bill, through this project, I'm assuming you've, let government officials know this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a specific plan that you would like to see them put forward?
Well, we've put forward the broad plan that we need to tackle poverty. And that would include raising the welfare rates.
How high do they need to be raised, do you say?
Let's put it this way. If welfare was at the same level as it was 25 years ago, in line with inflation, and people couldn't get by then, but there's a benchmark, it should be around $900.
Okay.
The poverty line is over $1,000 a month. So those are an indication of Ideally, we'd like to see it doubled to around 1,200, so that people can. And one of the points on that is that money will go back into the province, because if you are on welfare or if you're a low-paid worker and you get an increase in income, you're not going to spend it on a foreign holiday or put it in a tax haven. You're going to go and buy a pair of shoes for your kids or buy a pair of shoes for yourself or some more food. So it'll go back straight into the local economy, and the government is going to get some of it back in taxes.
Right.
So raise welfare, raise the minimum wage, build houses, which again, all across the province there's a shortage of housing. And again, that provides jobs for construction workers. And probably the other piece would be around child poverty, childcare.
Okay.
Because if you're in low income and you're trying to get back into work and you have children, you end up paying more for childcare than you do pay in your income. And if you put that all together, a total anti-poverty strategy, it would cost some people around $3 to $4 billion a year, which is a lot of money.
Right.
But the cost of poverty, the cost to the health service system alone of people in poverty is over $1 billion a year in British Columbia. And the health system knows that. They have these charts about, you know, the cost of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So the cost of poverty in BC in terms of health, education, children who are raised in poverty do poorer at school. Teachers say this, that, you know, the first thing they do in some classes is feed the kids.
Right.
So educational missed opportunities, health costs, crime costs, well, you add them all up, it comes to around $8 billion. So tackling poverty would save the province money. It wouldn't cost money. In the long term, it would save money. It's like doing maintenance on your house or your car. It costs a bit more up at the front.
In the long run.
But in the long run, you've still got a house or a car instead of it falling apart. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I was just at a presentation yesterday by a woman from First Call.
Oh, yeah.
Do you do much work with them? Because I know, like, their primary focus is,
they focus,
you know,
on child poverty. But we're all pushing for specific issues, but we're also all aware that the broad picture is, however you slice it and dice it, poverty is a problem. And, you know, kids are poor because their parents are poor. That a child in poverty doesn't live in a rich household and the parents say, oh, we've got money and we're not going to give you any. Kids who are poor because their parents are poor. Yeah.
Just a question about this challenge. I'm looking at the website, and so basically people are supposed to be only spending the $26, correct? They're not allowed to get food from other sources?
No.
Okay.
That's what the government says they need to get by. So we're taking the government's word that if the government thinks that's adequate, let's find out if it is.
Are you also trying to comment on, you know, the lacking resources at shelters and at charities?
Because
I know a lot of times food banks will run out of food before everyone has been fed.
I mean, we're aware of that, and that's a problem. But to be honest, what we're focusing on is welfare in this particular case.
Okay.
Because if people had a decent income, they wouldn't need to rely on food banks. And food banks were set up in this province 20-something years ago, quotes, as a temporary measure. They were supposed to be temporary. They're now an institution. And you talk, because we have talked to the people who run the food banks, who work in the food banks, mm-hmm. and they said they'd like nothing better than not have to do this.
Yeah.
Because we've done something about poverty. I mean, one of the other things that I think, again, relates is the myth about people on welfare, is that most people are on welfare for things that happen in life that you don't want to happen and you don't plan to happen.
Right.
Like, you lose your job. You know, the mill closes down,
yeah.
the shop closes down. You have a serious injury or illness. And, like, I know people who said, you know, my life plan was not to spend it in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
I got T-boned in a car crash, and I'm on welfare for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And the other ones are family breakdown and fleeing abuse and violence. Those are the main reasons why people are on welfare.
Yeah.
So they're all, like, the personal tragedies that most of us go, I hope those never happen to me. And people end up on welfare and are trying to get off it, but
Well, I mean,
they need to help up, not a push down.
Right, yeah, because I mean, like, you can't put anything away into savings when you only have when all you have left for food is $26.
Yep.
Like,
and
there's
no other money. And you can't even set aside money to do training. And I know people on welfare who have a qualification from another out of province, which isn't recognized in this province. If they got training, they could get a full-time job which paid reasonably well. But the training costs $1,500.
Yeah.
Welfare for people who are able-bodied will not train them. So it actually costs more to keep a person on welfare
than to provide the training.
And to provide the training. And it's like somebody somewhere is not putting one and one together. You know?
Now, would that... Because I know, like, yesterday she was talking about maybe trying to push for that funding to be provided.
Yeah.
Are you guys looking at that at all with this, or is it strictly
focusing on the specific money thing? But there are a whole raft of policies that the province could do, like training is one, childcare is another, that would also make a real difference.
Right.
And it's I guess it's where is the political direction? Where is the political motivation? I drive past the Portman Bridge, the new bridge, and as a piece of engineering, it is absolutely amazing that they built that bridge and the road kept going all the time.
Yeah.
And yet we can't work out a plan to end poverty. It's like, it's not complicated. It's, is there the will to do it? And, you know, the individual components of welfare, of minimum wage, of childcare, of training, all of those would be part of a strategy. And what we're trying to do is to raise public awareness. And most of the evidence is that when people know that somebody on welfare gets $610 a month, they go, you can't live on that.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. The government should do something, you know? But a lot of people don't know, and there's all those myths out there about, oh, it's, you know, people choose to be in welfare. I don't know anybody who's, I mean, like, get real.
No,
610
for sure.
bucks, you know, nobody chooses to live on that. So that's why we're doing it, is to highlight that you can't live on it. And again, the dietitian doing it, the dietitians say for a basic diet, not an extravagant diet,
right,
basic diet, a man should spend around $250 a month, a woman around $200 a month.
Wow.
It varies depending on age and body weight and what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But basically that means if you took all the money you get on welfare, apart from your housing part, and you spent it all on food, so you never had a bath, you never had a haircut, you never bought any clothes, you didn't have a bus pass, you didn't have a cell phone, you'd probably still not be able to get a basic healthy diet.
Wow.
And that's, I mean, so, and it's quite significant that one of the people doing it is a dietitian, and she's going, I know that.
It's built right next to the residences there. It's an ultra clean system. The emissions performance of our systems, it's one of the things that sets us apart. Very clean, obviously.
Nice.
An important part of being right there in the middle of campus. And I think I'm very proud of our team here, very pleased with our relationship with UBC and all our partners. And I periodically take my kids and my wife out to just check it out. We're all proud of what's been accomplished there. So it's a great thing.
Well, that sounds fantastic. You mentioned that it's right near the residences. So what buildings on UBC is this project powering?
Well, it all that's done is the power is going to UBC's what they call internal grid.
So okay.
Electrons are kind of fungible, so the electrons go into the grid, and then so it's kind of hard to track the electron. But essentially, what it does is it stays inside UBC's grid. A lot of the power that UBC uses, of course, comes from BC Hydro.
Right.
But once it gets across a substation, UBC manages its grid on its own.
Okay.
And so this power that we're producing is going onto UBC's grid. And BC Hydro is providing UBC with a credit for the green power that they're producing on campus.
And that's great, actually, that you mentioned that. I was going to ask about that. Do you, on the website I was looking at, it was talking about revenue to UBC. Do you know what level of revenue we'll be getting back from this project?
I can't specifically comment. I think if you certainly speak to the team at UBC, and I'm not sure what they're allowed to say about what their deal is with BC Hydro.
Right.
But the idea is to produce clean, renewable power and offset the money that would otherwise be paid to BC Hydro or paid to Fortis for natural gas. And so, and you'd ask the question about where the steam was going or which buildings were heated. Is it the same thing with the steam? It goes into UBC's steam system.
Okay.
And so, Where the molecule of steam ends up, I'm not sure, but it contributes to the overall heating of the campus. But
okay, cool.
Yeah.
You mentioned gasifying.
Yes.
What exactly is a gasifier?
Yeah, good question. Essentially, what happens is that you take, they call it a biomass material, which is, it could be woody biomass, or it could be, we've actually done work gasifying sewage sludge that's been dried out. So organic material. An organic goes into the gasifier. Let's use wood as an example, and it goes into a vessel chamber where you heat it up. But you heat it up, but you don't give it enough oxygen to fully burn the material.
Okay.
And what actually happens is that the solid biomass material converts into a gas. It's as simple as that.
Cool.
If you heat these materials up and you don't give it enough oxygen to burn, you create a gas, and that's what we do. And the basic process of gasifying these sorts of materials has been around for decades, almost more than a century. And people started doing it with coal and coal gasification. And so they'd take coal, they'd heat it up in an oxygen-starved environment, and they'd produce something they call coal gas or town gas. And that was actually the first sort of gas that was used in street lighting and those sorts of things. So the basic idea of gasification has been around a long time, but people have struggled, particularly with biomass materials, which are variable, not like coal, which tends to be quite consistent, to reliably develop a gas. And that's what sets NextEra apart. We're one of only a handful of companies in the world that have delivered commercially viable and reliable biomass gasification systems at the size that we're doing. We're building systems that are suited for, we call them small to medium scale applications, district energy, university campuses,
right,
industrial process, small scale power. And we're right here in Vancouver, sort of a world leader in the gasification space. There's actually going to be a big gasification conference out at UBC next month, chemical engineering conference of some sort. So that's gasification. I probably said too much about it all. It's pretty simple. The gas that we produce is in some respects kind of like natural gas, but it has a much lower heating value.
Okay.
And it's about 1/8 the heating value of natural gas on a sort of volume-to-volume comparison basis.
Is that a good thing?
Well, it's...
Or does that mean, like, it takes more of it to produce the same amount of heat?
It's a funny thing. It's a thing. It's not a good thing or a bad thing, fairly, in some applications. In other applications, it's not a great thing. But, for example, even though the gas that we produce that's being used in the engine only has about an eighth or less of the energy content of natural gas,
mm-hmm.
with that engine, we're able to produce about 75 to 80% of the power you'd be able to produce, 70 to 80% of the power you'd be able to produce using the same engine on natural gas.
Really?
So, yeah. So you'd
wow.
go, well, that seems weird, doesn't it? And when I started, I'm not an engineer, but it seemed weird to me too. But what it is that when you burn a gas in an engine like that, normally what you do is you put a little bit of fuel in and a lot of air.
Okay.
And so that's why with our gas, which has air in it and has less energy, you put a lot of our gas in and very little additional air.
Okay.
So what happens is you end up, even though the gas has less energy on, in it in any particular volume, it actually works. And the same thing applies when we burn our gas to produce heat. We need slightly bigger volumes to do it, but you still can produce the same amount of energy from the gas. And so it actually is not a not a bad thing per se.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I just want to ask about the sewage sludge.
Sure.
Do you guys have any, you know, future plans to try to organize something on UBC, like on UBC campus, to collect the sewage sludge? Is that in the future at all for NextEra?
I mean, the idea of taking sewage sludge, they call it biosolids, and using it as an energy source is something that's, again, it's been around for a long time. And gasification offers a potentially a much more environmentally friendly and cost-effective way of implementing that. People, in particular in Europe, but in parts of North America as well, and in Asia, have been, if you can believe it, just incinerating these biosolids in facilities. It often ends up going to landfills. So Metro Vancouver actually trucks its biosolids up into the interior.
Right. It's up to, like, Hope,
yeah,
right?
Cache Creek, I think, is where it ends up. And so we've done some fairly extensive testing up at our research facility. We've gasified the biosolids, and we're very confident that we can deliver a better mousetrap in the area and recover energy from those biosolids and use that energy to produce heat and power. But the real challenge with that application is that everybody that's in the wastewater treatment business, or many of them, very risk averse, and nobody wants to go first. So we've been looking at a variety of ways, potential partnerships, to get the first commercial demonstration of that solution up and running. To date, all we've been able to do it is our product development center. We've dealt with lots of groups, including Metro Vancouver, about the possibility of doing a demonstration. And so we'd love to do it, but we have not found the right way to get it done. I think UBC doesn't process its own
waste,
sewage.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that question. Somebody actually asked me that last week, so I don't know the answer to that question. But we're only the second company in the world that's gas, to the best of our knowledge, anyways, that's gasified sewage sludge, taken that gas, cleaned it up, and fired it into an engine. So just like what we're doing at UBC, we've done it at our product development center.
Right.
I don't think anybody has any intention of putting sewage sludge into the system next to the Totem residence. That's not in the cards. But it is something, the treatment of these biosolids, disposing of them, capturing energy from them, is something that we, you know, think is a very attractive thing. And, you know, everywhere you go in the world, there are biosolids, and it's a growing problem. It's a global problem,
yeah.
And we think we have a good solution for it.
That's really cool. I think that's an awesome development.
We think it is cool, too. We just love to get the first one of them going, because we would actually be using exactly the same core technology without any changes to the design that we use for these other waste materials.
Sweet.
So it's ready to go. And so if any of your listeners are out there are got a bunch of biosolids they want, they can give us a call.
Sounds great.
It's not likely, I know.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. That was fantastic.
My pleasure. Thanks.
No, good luck with any future projects, and I'll definitely make sure I get out there and check it out.
Yeah, you should check it out. It's just
that sounds really cool.
At the corner of Agronomy and West Mall, I think. It's okay. Very close to
Right down by Totem and Marine, hey?
Yeah, right by Northwest Marine Drive there. So and you can walk by the outside of it. It's a beautiful building with lots of glass, and it's definitely worth taking a wander by.
Definitely will. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Have a good rest of your day.
Thanks. You too, Morgan.
All right. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
And thank you to Mike Scott for that interview with me earlier today.
You can listen to that interview once again on our website, citr.ca/news.
Or on our Facebook page. You can also find the link there. I will post that later. And now we go to Phil Chang with our weekend weather forecast.
Cool. So the air pressure outside right now is 101.5 kilopascal. Overall, still falling gradually, approaching one standard atmosphere. Broadly speaking, dropping pressures are associated with the onset of weather, but because of the vacancy of pressure from above, the warm surface air rises and we get clouds. But yes, in today's case, we are very fortunate in that in the grand scheme of things, we've already experienced the lowest part of the system, called the trough, around 1 p.m. today. So next up coming our way is local pressure maxima ridges, which is great news, as this means despite some odd showers accumulating about 2.5 millimeters of precipitation throughout today, the chances of rain tomorrow and Sunday is unlikely. So our station's forecast is patches of high altitude clouds on both days of this weekend for UBC campus. And now here is the official weather summary for the next 3 days by Environment Canada. Today, mainly cloudy, a few showers beginning this afternoon, high of 21. Tonight, cloudy with 40% chance of showers, low of 13. Saturday, cloudy, clearing at near noon, high of 18. Sunday, also cloudy, low of 10, high of 15. So, yeah, there's your weather weekend forecast, and please join us again on Monday for News 101.
Thank you, Phil. We're going now to FSRN for some headlines.
We apologize for that technical difficulty, but here it is now.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. In Philadelphia, a state judge today overturned the sentence of death row inmate Terrence Williams, who was scheduled to be executed early next week. From Philadelphia, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo has more.
Terrence Williams was convicted for a murder he committed during a 1984 robbery. He was 18 at the time when he killed a 56-year-old man who he says had repeatedly sexually abused him. Williams had been sentenced to die next Wednesday, but a Philadelphia Common Pleas Court judge today overturned that sentence. Defense attorney Sean Nolan says the judge focused on the district attorney's decision to hide evidence that Williams' victim sexually abused him and other teenage boys.
And they did not turn that evidence over to the defense. And what she found is that that would have changed the verdict at the penalty phase and that the jury would not have voted for death if they had known those things.
The DA could file an emergency appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court or accept the decision and go to a new death penalty hearing. The DA could alternatively allow a life sentence to be imposed, as had previously been done in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, Philadelphia.
A court in Louisiana has exonerated a man who had been on death row for 15 years. Damon Thibodeau walked out of prison today after forensic and DNA evidence cleared him in the rape and murder of a young relative. The ACLU says his conviction was based almost entirely on a false confession to police. More than 7 years after Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, thousands who lost their homes and were temporarily sheltered in formaldehyde-riddled FEMA trailers are finally getting some closure. FSRN's Zoe Sullivan has the details.
In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, FEMA trailers were used to house displaced Gulf Coast residents. The trailers were sold to the government by private companies. In the months following the storm, residents began complaining about health issues. Testing found formaldehyde levels in the trailers that exceeded federal safety limits. Formaldehyde is a carcinogen and can cause respiratory and other health problems. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Englehart approved a $42.6 million class action settlement. Most of the money comes from trailer manufacturers. The settlement is reported to resolve almost all the remaining claims on the issue and makes approximately 55,000 Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Texas residents eligible for payouts. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
Next Wednesday, President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney will debate for the first time. The economy and jobs are sure to be major focuses, but environmental and health groups are lobbying moderators to broach the issue of climate change. These organizations delivered 120,000 signatures to debate moderator Jim Lehrer yesterday from people who think President Obama and Romney should clarify their positions on climate change and their ideas for dealing with it. Mike Palamuso is with the League of Conservation Voters.
Many voters are going to be tuning into this presidential race for the first time during these debates. So even if these candidates are discussing these issues on the campaign trail, it's important for this to be front and center on the national stage during this first presidential debate.
Palamuso says the conversation should expand beyond statements of belief or disbelief in the science. He says candidates should also address energy policy in light of changing climate conditions. The Austin City Council has endorsed marriage equality, making it the first city in Texas to support same-sex marriage. The six-person board passed the resolution unanimously Thursday. Although largely a symbolic gesture, the resolution criticizes the Defense of Marriage Act and calls efforts by Texas to prohibit marriage recognition for same-sex couples discriminatory and inconsistent with Austin's commitment to equal rights. The final resolution simply states, "We support marriage equality in the state of Texas." Saudi Arabia is sending home more than 1,000 Nigerian women it detained as they tried to make the pilgrimage to Mecca. Saudi officials held the women because they did not have a male escort. In protest, the Nigerian government issued a 48-hour suspension of all pilgrimage flights from its airports. FSRN Samuel Okocha reports from the Nigerian capital.
Before now, the rule requiring a woman to be accompanied by a male guardian, known as a mahram, appeared to have been relaxed for Nigerian pilgrims who face no such requirement under Nigeria's secular government. But current affairs analyst Yinka Salam tells FSRN that the rule had always been enforced. It says before now, the number of Nigerian women pilgrims equaled their male counterparts, giving the impression of supervision. This time, however, more than 1,000 female pilgrims arrived in Saudi Arabia alone. Earlier this week, Saudi authorities sent 171 female pilgrims back to Nigeria. More followed today. This prompted the government to suspend pilgrimage flights to Mecca, where more than 2 million Muslims from around the world are expected to gather in late October. Some save for years in order to make the Hajj, which Muslims are required to complete once in their lives. Some of the deported women have complained of poor detention conditions and humiliating treatment by Saudi officials. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
So that's our program for today, Friday, September 28th, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can also subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Phil Chang.
And I'm Morgan Yee. Today's show was produced by Shiraj Mahajan.
It was produced by Chirag Mahajan. From the entire news team, who is butchering my name at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.